Strike my last comment from the record. I'm sorry. That came out completely wrong.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 361, recorded on September 11th, 2014.
Welcome to the 361st edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 194th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
And I am Jonah Falcon.
VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry and includes gaming flashback.
You know, the title of this podcast will probably be, "So You Want to Develop Video Games."
Oh dear God. Is this part of your ongoing attempt to make me feel special and wanted?
No, it's my ongoing attempt to get news, and, you know, it's been a pretty slow news day, but there is a little bit of a theme in some of the news items. So, I mean, it's perfect that you're here, because then you'll be able to give your expert advice on it.
Okay. Okay.
What is this? It's sort of like the teacher sigh?
Pretty much. It's like I want to grow up and be a teacher. It's like, really? Okay. I'm going to tell you all the reasons why you don't.
So, what have you been playing?
Oh, dear God. What day is it? Thursday?
Yes.
I've been reading a lot this week. I'm sorry. I got caught up in the Iron Druid Chronicles, and I've read 4 books this week.
Okay.
I'm so ashamed.
We're doing this a day late because Paul had something to do yesterday.
I did. I had to take a round trip, quick kamikaze tour of San Francisco. Something I don't really recommend when you have to, like, get on a flight at 4 in the morning.
Wait, was this job related?
This
trip to San Francisco.
That's an awfully impertinent question, Mr. Falcon.
Well, considering San Francisco is where a crap ton of developers are.
I will say only that I was there for about 12 hours.
Oh, okay. So hopefully you got an interview and hopefully you'll say, hey, guess what? I'm working now. At least
rumors of my activities can neither be confirmed nor denied.
Okay. So you were touring San Francisco for 12 hours.
I did. I toured. You could see an awful lot of San Francisco in 12 hours.
A friend of mine worked at LucasArts, so I was pretty much familiar with the Palace of Fine Arts. Because LucasArts, for those that you don't know, is right next to the Palace of Fine Arts.
Ah, yes.
So, but I did get to take a picture of myself with Han Solo encased in carbonite. But, you know.
Well, there you go. And who doesn't need a picture like that? Oh, wait, me.
You don't need it? You don't care?
Nah, I got one when I was a teenager.
Oh, I'll get a picture of you with one of the characters from My Little Pony, then.
I have that already. I've been to BronyCon.
Oh, really?
Yes. I have a picture of me in Twilight Sparkle.
Okay, so is that your favorite Brony? Is that your favorite pony?
No, Rainbow Dash is best pony.
Okay. So, and I'm pretty sure all the bronies out there will be nodding their heads in agreement. So,
most of them, yes. And I frankly would love to hear all of your thoughts on who is best pony, if you dare have the bad taste to disagree with me.
You know, that reminds me of, there was this promo, and you remember Fraggle Rock, right? They had Red and Gobo talking about the show maybe coming back. And there's been a movie script in the works for years and years and years. And nothing's...
Oh, yeah. But there was a Gem in the Holograms movie script in the works for years and years and years. And then, I don't know, they've been awfully quiet since they stopped filming. And people have written to them telling them that their concept sounds like shit.
Yeah. And anyway, hold on 1 second. I got to put this on pause for a moment. So, you know, there was a Ask a Fraggle promo with Bobo and Red. And it was themselves in character, right? And by the way, Gobo was speaking for the first time in 20 years, voiced by a new character. But one of the questions sent to them were, are you guys bronies? Red says, Gobo says, oh, yeah, Thomas. Red says, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, without a doubt. And Red says, yeah, what's a brony? Gobo, I have no idea. I don't know either. No, Thomas, we're Fraggles. Yeah, yeah. Gobo says, we like to sing and dance. And Red says, we like to play with our friends. And Gobo says, yeah, because friendship is magic. So anyways. So
clearly somebody was, you know, some poor stagehand was looking that up for them rather quickly.
I think that was a brilliant piece of improv there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyways, so this episode may be short, it may be long, I don't know. But because there's not much news, it's still sort of the dog days of video game development. Big games are starting to come out. Oh, and getting back to what you've been playing, I have been playing Destiny. I only had one play session because I got it on Tuesday. I plan to play it more, but, you know, it's interesting for a MMO shooter, you know. A lot of people have been saying that the writing has been awful, but I haven't seen that yet. Maybe if I go later into the game, I don't know. But writing in an MMO, you know, I mean, and they say that Peter Dinklage sounds bored, but if the writing is bad, maybe there's a reason he's bored.
There you go.
But yeah, I love Peter Dinklage. He has a great voice. He has a hypnotic voice. What?
I like his name, Dinklage.
Peter Dinklage.
Dinklage.
He first got noticed from the station agent. I still have yet to see that movie.
Sounds like the sound a spoon makes when you drop it into a glass.
Dinklage. Could be worse. Anyways, I'm gonna take the first one because the third one is gonna be really long, and I know you don't wanna. And also, you have to listen to it, the third one, so that you can digest it and have your long response.
Yeah, I have this thing where if words go from the screen through my eyes into my mouth, that often bypasses my brain.
Yeah. Anyway,
so I don't really recall what I've read when I have to do a cold reading out loud.
Right. The first item is report: Microsoft to buy Mojang, and this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. Reports earlier today revealed that Microsoft could be about to secure a massive deal with the purchase of Minecraft studio Mojang. The Wall Street Journal cites a person with knowledge of the matter claims the sale is worth $2 billion and could be signed and sealed later this week. Mojang founder Marcus Notch Person may have instigated the negotiations with Microsoft after reaching out to the company several months ago. Many in the games industry and games press have been reacted with surprise at the possibility of Microsoft acquiring Mojang, not least because Person has been openly critical of the company in the past. However, Bloomberg sources have claimed that Person has actually proposed the deal in the first place, largely due to a quote-unquote positive working relationship and a close relationship, unquote, with Xbox boss Phil Spencer. According to Bloomberg, a person will remain at Mojang to see the deal and subsequent merger through the completion, but will likely depart once that has happened. In March, it was revealed that Mojang made $129 million in profit in 2013, so it's not hard to see why Microsoft might be interested. So the first thing...
You know what? The goal of many startups is to become successful and then quickly get bought out.
Yeah,
so that you don't have to keep making games for the rest of your life.
Right. See Oculus Rift, you know.
Yeah, I mean, don't kid yourself, guys. Like, making games is hard work.
I mean, a Marcus Person made a crap ton of money. And if this goes through, $2 billion, you got to understand, you know, there's something called, stock options, right?
Oh, yeah,
stock options. And then you cash in those stock options, you make a windfall.
And those usually get vested after like 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. So, yeah, he's going to make a windfall. It's interesting because Minecraft finally landed on the PlayStation 4.
Lovely.
And if Microsoft owns it, PlayStation owners better get used, better. You know, cuddle up to that one because that might be the last Minecraft they ever see. You know, now they can't. Microsoft won't, delete it from their drives or something like that. But
you know what? They might start getting into a new business dynamic there of having an owned IP such as Minecraft, and then having other systems license it out to have it on their systems as well. I mean, at that point, it's just sitting back and collecting money.
Makes me wonder if they're, they'll probably. You know, they're not going to do anything dickish like stop, you know, technical support. You know, oh, you have it on the PS3 or PS4? Well, guess what? We're not going to help you. You know, they're not going to do that.
Right, because, I mean, it's still their product out there somewhere.
The one thing I wonder is if this is a one-trick pony. I mean, Mojang's done Minecraft and they've done Scrolls and that's it. You know, I mean, you have these companies like King Entertainment did Candy Crush, right?
And they also did like 50 other games before that, though.
But those didn't sell, and the ones they've made after that haven't sold. You know, everything's Candy Crush, and that stock is starting to decrease because people are realizing all they did was Candy Crush. You know, and you have to, you know, does Mojang have any new ideas? And one thing that people will also think about when they hear Microsoft acquiring Mojang is what happened to Rare. And people are worried that what happened to Rare will happen to Mojang. Not that Rare has been a complete and utter flop with Microsoft. I mean, Viva Pinata and Conquer, you know, the Conquer remake. But it hasn't borne the fruit that Rare did during their, you know, their heyday with Nintendo, you know. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with Mojang there.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising when you hear of a deal like this in the works. But I'll preface that comment by saying that a rumor is just a rumor. I mean,
well,
I can
actually,
go ahead, you know,
person sort of semi-confirmed it. So, I mean, we still don't know what the actual money is going to be. If it's $2 billion, but you know, the thing is that Microsoft bought Skype and it's worked out for them. So it's not like, you know, everything becomes a disaster. It's not like things wilt under their touch, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, words are just words is my point.
Yeah.
So yes, we could all say sources close to, you know, Disney CEO, whatever, it, you know, says X, Y, and Z, to create a rumor because words are cheap, as any writer will know.
You know,
but you know, facts are not cheap.
I just had a thought, and if there's
don't hurt yourself.
If there's something that really goes well with Minecraft, it's Project Spark, and I could see a lot of synergy between the two. You know, Project Spark and Minecraft.
Okay.
It's you know Project Spark, right?
I'm unfamiliar.
Oh, Project Spark is a 3D. Game making, I have to call it an app for Xbox One, Xbox 360, and PC, Windows 8 PC, that makes game making really, really, really easy. It's a free app. You should try it out if you haven't already, in which, you know, you manipulate things, you give things properties, you know, like this rock will follow you and it will attack you if you attack it, you know, that sort of thing. You know, it's sort of like programming tools, you know, teaching people to program. And they've actually done some incredible stuff with it. Right now, the base game is a third-person action-adventure thing in which, you know, you run around in this landscape. But, you know, it has enough tools that you can do anything like Space Invaders or something like that, you know. So I'm just thinking, you know, that melds really well with it. So, anyways, we're going to move on to the next item.
Destiny Day 1 shipments top 500 million, and this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. Bungie's Destiny saw a release yesterday.
Well,
beginning.
Tuesday, so this is a day old item, I guess.
Beginning the payoff for a $500 million investment by publisher Activision. The investment is starting to look like a shrewd one, as Activision today announced that it has sold in more than 500 million in Destiny copies to retail stores and first-party platform holders for the launch, proclaiming it the biggest new franchise launch in gaming history. Since the beginning, we've been confident that our investment and belief in Destiny would pay off, said Activision Publishing CEO Eric Hirschberg. But not many people believed we'd be able to say it did so on day one. Destiny is officially the biggest new franchise launch in our industry's history. It is also the highest-selling day-one digital console release in history. We have more confidence than ever that Destiny will become one of the iconic franchises of this generation and Activision's next billion-dollar brand. Destiny is the latest in the string of new Activision Blizzard franchises to find success in recent years. The Skylander series tallied in $1.5 billion in lifetime revenue after just 2 years on the market, and created a toys-to-life genre that has attracted competitors like Disney and Nintendo. On the Blizzard side of the business, Hearthstone has been a conspicuous success. While the company hasn't yet broken out the performance of the online card game in concrete terms, it was cited as a primary driver of digital revenues last quarter.
You know, saying that you have the number day one digital console release, the highest selling. That's not saying much. That's not exactly a broad, you know, there haven't been that many, you know, digital releases, new digital releases on console. So, but Bungie seems to have a Midas touch because, you know, the biggest selling game before the Call of Duty franchises came along were Halo 2 and Halo 3, you know, and they were responsible for that. And, you know, it's going to be related in the next item. Well, we say their games are always extremely polished. We'll get back to that term polish later.
I like polished games.
It'll be a watchword for the next item that we read. So, your thoughts?
My thoughts on Activision doing well. Yay!
Well, Bungie.
Congratulations, Activision.
I mean, you know, remember we had this discussion before about Activision choosing to do the big IPs, you know, basically focusing on four or five huge, huge IPs and letting the rest, you know, de-emphasizing the rest so that, you know, Call of Duty, Destiny, Skylanders and World of Warcraft, that sort of thing, you know. So they're making this model work, you know, just concentrating on Civ, really, really, really big AAA titles, you know, while Electronic Arts has done the opposite. You know, they've gone more towards looking at smaller IPs and, you know, diversifying AAA stuff. I mean, not AAA, but, you know, indie stuff. So it's interesting to see this model is working. The only thing is that Bungie's going to have to work a lot harder with Destiny than they ever did with Halo, because the thing about Destiny is that it's an MMO and you have to create new content over and over. You know, you can't let it slough off because people will get bored and they'll stop playing.
Right.
So, I mean, you have your experiences with MMOs. Like last week, we were talking about City of Heroes. Did you ever feel like you were lacking for content, endgame content in City of Heroes?
No, because I didn't absorb the content as quickly as it would come out.
Okay.
But it just became
empty. That was your problem.
It became empty, and the content stopped being appealing. After I started seeing seasonal content get reused, I just moved on to other things.
They were having people create their own content, though. You know, their own instances. Do you ever do any of that?
Yeah, except it was all out of prefabbed pieces.
Oh.
So it was like, which neighborhood of McMansions do you want to walk through today?
McMansions. You mean that was a popular tile set, the mansion?
No, it's actually a quite clever reference to prefabricated architecture in the real world.
Oh, okay.
Have you ever walked through a McMansion neighborhood?
I've walked through Beverly Hills, so I guess the answer would be yes. and Bel Air.
Okay, well, for our younger listeners, you know, you can go ahead, the same way that you can with schools and other buildings, you can replicate buildings over and over again from the same set of plans. And you can go ahead and do the same thing with only minor variations. And this is really common in the building and housing industries. And when you do that with, you know, a row of million-dollar homes, they all kind of stop feeling special. They kind of just feel homogenous and kind of boring, and it's like you're only buying it so that you could say you have a $1 million home and you didn't spend the time to like make your own. And that's kind of what I was saying about that content in City of Heroes as well.
Yeah. So we're going to move on to the next item. And Paul is now going to put on his thinking cap and listen, because there's going to be a lot of information here that he'll probably have a lot of opinions about. So we all like it when Paul gets opinionated. So Dan Adelman, quote unquote, good games are worth paying for. And this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. When Dan Adelman
and water is wet in other news.
Well, actually, he means it in a different way. So when Dan,
I'm just saying the headline hasn't grabbed me.
Yeah. When Dan Adelman ended his 9 years at Nintendo, he did so with one of the finest tweets you're ever likely to see. As head of digital content and development, a significant part of Adelman's job. Sorry about that. As head of digital content and development, a significant part of Adelman's job was to be the approachable face of Nintendo to the great swelling wave of indie developers that emerged since he joined the company in 2005. But by early 2014, it had become clear that Adelman was no longer able to freely use most direct communicative tool at his disposal Twitter. The day he broke his silence was also the day he announced his decision to leave Nintendo altogether, and he did it like this. Happy to announce I have reached an agreement with Nintendo of America whereby I can tweet again. Arrangement includes my not working there anymore. The truth may be
that's cute.
Yeah, the truth may be less vitriolic, but no less industry. That tweet made for great copy, sure, but it also created a false impression of why Adelman decided to close that chapter of his life and move on to the next. After a total of 14 years working in business development for console companies, prior to Nintendo, he also spent 5 years at Xbox. He felt the time was right, that he had accumulated knowledge and experience to help the industry's most creative people realize their ambitions, that is, indie developers. According to Adelman, the cost of development is definitely lower than ever before, but the number of really talented designers isn't going to increase significantly in such a short window of time. My daughter went to a summer camp where they taught the basics of Unity for a week, like a computer camp, and by the end of the week, she had an endless runner game that was probably comparable to a lot of stuff on the App Store, the Apple App Store, I assume he means. She couldn't compete with someone who's really talented at design. It's a craft, and not everyone who thinks they can be a great game designer will become one. A lot of indie developers who become quote-unquote overnight successes were working at it for 10 years. A piece of advice I give to a lot of developers is to put your personality into it and make it your game. But then find out who's going to like that game, find out where that niche market is, because each individual game can be a niche market. Then make sure you go back and really polish that game and iterate on that game so it really owns that niche. I've seen too many games where the person doing the art is all about cute and fluffy, while the person doing the mechanic is all about hardcore gameplay. There's a mismatch. Adelman has the luxury of picking and choosing who he will work with in this new phase of his career, and while he hasn't been able to reveal any specific plans yet, it's clear that free-to-play games aren't high on his wish list. Even in the more, quote-unquote, ethical manifestations of the freemium model, which don't use, quote-unquote, psychological tricks to goad the player into opening their wallet, Adelman will still be reluctant to be involved in their development. Ultimately, his stance comes down to a very simple, very important belief: good games are worth paying for. Anyway, so what he meant wasn't that good games are worth paying for in terms of, you know, buying them, but he just doesn't like free-to-play games. You know, he prefers pay-for games. So,
oh my God, there is so much right with what he has to say, and I really want to know why when I say the same things on this podcast, nobody bothers to write in to agree with me.
Nobody writes in as in...
Nobody bothers to write in to agree with me or say, thank you, Paul, for opening our eyes.
Actually, I think that's been done before, except you weren't around.
Whatever. I mean, you know, there's so many things that he's absolutely right about. I mean, this little anecdote about his story, you know, about his daughter. It's great to learn how to program and to practice, you know, doing things that have already been done in our industry, because I'm sure it will help you reach the point of innovation. But you can't just kind of copy and think that you are, you know, one of the greatest game designers ever. You kind of have to innovate and make something new. I mean, we were talking about this earlier with King and Candy Crush. They've seen a fantastic amount of success with a game mechanic that has been around for at least 30 years.
Well, I mean, it's not exactly Match 3. I'm not sure. Well, I know where they got it from. I mean, we already know that they weren't exactly innovating there either with Candy Crush.
That's my point. Like, just because you can, like, so basically he's using this anecdote of his daughter saying, like, just because you can copy and know how to program something, you know, that has been done before, doesn't make you a brilliant game designer.
But the other thing that he says is that while you may be a great designer, if you don't market it well, no one's going to care either. And that's what Candy Crush did, was it marketed that thing the heck. And that's why it is a multi-billion thing. While Candy Swipe is, you know, a nice, you know, is the original, but few people would know about it if they didn't know that Candy Crush took from it. So, you know, he's also – that's what his job is going to be apparently, is that he's going to find selective indie developers mm-hmm. and you know, mentor them in terms of – well, you have to polish this and that, but also how to market their game, you know, and make it – you know. And the thing is that also apparently that, you know, you want to be consistent with your design. I mean, he talked about, well, it looks light and fluffy, but the – game mechanics are hardcore, you know, those don't meld. I mean, that's not necessarily true, but if you're going to do that, you have to be really good.
Right. Yeah, it has to be deliberate. It's kind of like writing. You have to know the laws of grammar and be well practiced at them before you can go and deliberately break them in interesting ways. And that's kind of the same thing that's going on here. You know, you kind of have to know about, you know, the effects of graphics and visual aesthetics and its relationship to gameplay mechanics and design, you know, before you can try to create something new by breaking that through intentional cognitive dissonance rather than just fucking up your game. I mean, there's a difference. But like, oh, well, again, like when he says that, you know, overnight, what's the saying? It takes 10 years to be an overnight success.
Yeah, he said something like that. You know, these guys.
No, but I mean, that's an old maxim.
These guys who were overnight successes, they'd been working on their craft for, you know, or the game for 10 years or something.
Right, but that's an old maxim. Again, that's not even an original thought. Like, that's like him saying that just goes to show that people have said this long before he has. These are not original thoughts. These are fundamental truths of our industry. And he's just repeating them. And it's always great because the more people repeat them, the more other people might hear them and pick up on them earlier.
Well, I know your favorite from Miyamoto is, you know, what's it called? You know, about delaying games, you know, that a bad game is bad forever. You know, that quote.
That's true. But, you know, also at the same time, games are never finished. You just kind of have to stop working on them after a while.
Yeah. I mean, there's something.
I mean, that's been my experience. Games are never finished.
Well, you know, there's something we like to call feature creep, which is a real danger. That's what happens when you work too long, you start doing feature creep, and then you just glom down your game and it's no longer fun.
But that's something different than the thought that I was expressing.
Okay. Well, what was the thought you were expressing?
The thought that I was expressing is that there's always something you can do to make a game better, which is different than trying to shove in things that don't have a business being there, which is what feature creep is.
Yeah. Something that Sid Meier does is that he comes out with incredibly addictive games, right? But what the reason that is that, you know, he has a very good sensor. And by that, you know, he had started a game called Dinosaurs, which was basically going to be sort of like a Civilization, but for dinosaurs, you know, which you evolve and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And early in development, he just stopped. And he said, you know what, this isn't working. It's not fun. So I'm just going to stop and, you know, let it go. You know, there's at some point that you have to say, you know what, this isn't really that fun. You know, I'm not going to keep on trying to make a game that's not fun better. Just, you know, he starts a lot of projects and just sticks with the ones that's, you know, that work, you know, sort of like the equivalent of throwing stuff for the wall and seeing what sticks. But, you know, he has an understanding that, you know, if I even the failures, you know, he'll learn something from.
And that's why his name is on the box.
Yeah. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. And this is, again, related to what we've been talking about. Video game degrees.
Video game degrees in the U.S. increased by 50% in 5 years. And this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. According to two statistics released by the ESA, United States educators are taking video games more seriously than ever before. 390 colleges, universities, and other academic institutions across the 50 states now offer professional certificates, undergraduate and graduate degrees in the subject, an increase of 50% over 2009's total of 254. The greatest number of courses can be found in California, where 73 are available, followed by 26 in New York, 24 in Illinois, and in Texas. President and CEO of the ESA, Michael D. Gallagher, said of the news, "Today's colleges and universities are responding to student demand for high-quality and innovative game design programs." Drew Davidson, director of the Entertainment Technology Center at Carnegie Mellon University, welcomed the news, adding, quote, "This is only going to increase the influence video games have in our culture as students graduate with more of a critical grasp of unique capabilities of games and apply that to their careers and lives." The news follows the foundation in July this year for the Higher Education Video Game Alliance, an organization that seeks to bring universities and college offerings through courses together and represent them to the outside media.
I know what you're thinking. You're just thinking, oh God, more competition.
That really wasn't at all what I was thinking, so please don't put words in my mouth. So please don't put words in my mouth.
Okay. Would you like to put it in my mouth?
a glass of water, quite frankly, because I forgot to bring one to the studio. anyway, as I was about to say, you know, fantastic. The number of degrees is going up in the country. But like, if you look at this news critically, it doesn't say anything about the quality of these degree programs. And we can just see this as for-profit institutions responding to market demand.
So, yeah, but, you know, I think they're referring more to established universities and not stuff like the University of Phoenix, you know, those things you see on TV. You know, I mean,
hey, I'm sure – not to knock the University of Phoenix. I'm sure lots and lots of people have found great amounts of success after being – you know, after having gotten some kind of credentials from the University of Phoenix, because it's a for-profit business. And if people did not have – you know, if there weren't success cases somewhere there, that business – would fail and, you know, stop selling degrees.
No, I was surprised that there were you know, quote unquote, fewer in Texas, because, you know, Austin and Texas as a whole is a hotbed for video game development, you know.
Yeah, but that doesn't really have anything to do with education.
Well, it could. I mean, you know, you might want to work where you just studied.
Yeah, but I mean, how many colleges per capita are in Texas?
A lot, actually. It's a big state.
Well, yeah, it's a big state, but is it bigger than, say, California?
No, well, California has a lot of colleges.
I think we're looking at size, population density, and the number of big name universities, as opposed to that specific location's connection to the existing games industry.
Yeah, I would say, you know, that I know of specifically some of the colleges in California that are offering very highly touted video game things. And I think it's like USC and UCLA and that sort of stuff. You know, these major colleges. NYU, I'm pretty sure, as a matter of fact, they have something called Game Center, which I applied to work in, but apparently you have to be a student to work there, even though they said they really wanted to hire me because of my experience.
So why wouldn't you enroll in a class?
No, you have to be an undergraduate. So.
Oh, so they want free labor. Fantastic.
Well, no, they were paying. I mean, it's not intern work. They want someone within the college. Anyway, I do get invited to their seminars and all that as media, but, you know. So I just found it interesting to see how you react.
My reaction is you know, buyer beware. I mean, my generation and the generations after me were kind of sold a bill of goods about, you know, go to school, do your absolute best, and eventually you'll be able to get out and get the job that you want. And that's not true.
You'd be surprised.
Especially in the games industry.
You'd be surprised at how many jobs people get that they didn't study for. So.
Oh, my God. It's like nobody uses their degree. In undergraduate, it's like you have to have a master's just to be competitive in this day and age. But that's like besides the point. It's like, understand that college is not a requirement, especially for making video games.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they did say in the previous article that the cost of development has gone way, way down. I mean, you know, there are plenty of tools out there.
Absolutely. Go to coding camp in the summer if you're really that interested. You know, I've got a cousin who's been making video games since he was 12.
Here's the thing, though, and I'm pretty sure you'll agree. If you really want to get in the video game industry, the first thing that you have to understand is that a good year or two is going to be beta testing, you know, game testing. That's what they're going to have you do as part of your, you know, as part of your career in the beginning is, you know, game testing and all that. I know that
that has absolutely not been my personal experience, so I'll just throw that out there.
You may not, but usually it's the best way to get in. Because I can know from
don't believe
like
that at all.
The game developers I know who are at the GGP have all had to deal with that. I mean, it's a good way to get in. Let's put it that way.
The classic advice is that it's a good way to get in, which is something that I completely disagree with.
But the other way you can do it is just make a game and see if you attract any attention.
That is much better advice. Go make a game before you go to school, you know, before you go and spend $30,000, $100,000 on a fancy-ass degree, which may or may not help you.
Well, the thing
spend is, your high school years making games.
Well, look at Juilliard. You know, you have to audition for Juilliard. You know, they don't
is
just
Juilliard think, offering a game-making class?
No, what I'm saying
then
is
then how is
that,
it relevant to this conversation?
Well, here's the thing. They have to prove themselves before they can get in. And what you're saying is, you know, you should prove that you can do this before you start, you know, committing, you know. I mean,
no, the point is that you don't have to get one of these fancy-ass degrees. I mean, yes, I have one, but I learned this after the fact.
I'm not talking about degrees. I'm talking about learning the craft. I mean,
right,
so
exactly.
Degree,
and you don't
know,
have, and you don't have to wait for you to get to college for that to happen. Go to the library. Get a free book.
Yeah.
And you know? And it's like, and let's say, you know, that there that you have decided that you want to get a degree in game design. That is fantastic. I cannot stress how much I have appreciated my degree and what it has done to change my life. But you have to do your homework and look into exactly what that program is going to be teaching you. Like, ask who the professors are and what games they've worked at. You know, ask how long they've been in the industry. When was the last time they've been to a conference? What conference? Have they spoken at any conferences? Like, you have to really dig in deep. You can't just buy the name of the university and the name of your degree program. Because oftentimes, you know, you might end up being taught a whole bunch of things that aren't really considered game design when you get down to it.
If you ever wanted to hear Paul being passionate, this is it.
Oh my God, you can't, buyer beware, buyer beware. Understand that as a student, once you get past the age of 18, you are no longer required to go to school. You are now a customer and you have to do your homework literally as well as figuratively.
Okay.
Or figuratively as well as literally.
We move on to the next item. European Women in Games Hall of Fame adds new members, and this comes to us from Games Industry Biz. The European Women in Games Hall of Fame got two new members yesterday as Kings. The European Women. Damn it. I'm stumbling over the copy today. The European Women in Games Hall of Fame got two new members yesterday as Kings Katarina Lavers Mallet and Marie Claire Isaman from the Norwich University of the Arts were inducted. Lavers Mallet, I am very proud and grateful to be a part of this group which supports women working in the games industry. Thank you this so much for this award and to Women in Games Jobs for organizing such a useful and helpful event for women in our industry. The Hall of Fame was created in 2011 and sponsored by Electronic Arts as a part of a European Women in Games conference. The other nominees this year were Roberta Lucca and Debbie Bestwick. Yesterday's event at Yesterday's event in London South Bank University sold out and featured talks from Liz Weil, head of studio at Natural Motion, and Lucy Preble, one of the key writers in Bungie's Destiny. I am delighted to receive this award, added Isaman. It's wonderful to get recognition for the work we do at Norwich University of the Arts in nurturing and supporting talent into the games industry, and I see this not only as an award for myself, but both for my course team and my students. By the way, right there, you were talking about, you know, study your college course as well. There you
absolutely
go.
Like, look who's teaching you. Hey, we have award winners teaching our school. You might actually get something out of being taught by these people.
Now, the thing that strikes me is
Dude, I wish I had somebody telling me this stuff when I was 18, not for nothing. Like, I just went to and got my undergraduate degree because, like, it was expected of me by my immigrant parents. Like, I had no idea. Like, I went to school for the first year undecided.
You know, getting a degree is more of a social thing than it is an actual practical, you know, getting work thing.
Right, because our mandatory educational system has failed our society, but it's a completely different story.
No, it's more like you're independent. You know, you're semi-independent, you know, and you're learning how to work. You know, it's not what you're learning, it's how you're learning it, you know.
You mean because our society imposes an artificial period of adolescence in our 20-year-olds?
No, that's not what I'm saying. Stop putting words in my mouth now. Getting back to
I'm sorry. I'm just asking questions in a really pointed way to bring up salient tangential points in case you wanted this podcast to last longer than 40 minutes.
Getting back to the item, I had not known that there was a Hall of Fame for female developers, although I'm not surprised it's European because here in the United States, we still haven't advanced that far yet when it comes to women in gaming. I mean, it's sad but true, you know?
I mean, I could name half a dozen female workers, you know, female video game makers just off the top of my head. But I mean, that's kind of not really the point here. There are many more women working today in the games industry than I think the average consumer realizes. But I think it's because the average consumer doesn't stop long enough to think about things like that. And so that's why there are these organizations and campaigns that rightfully do some really good work in helping to make these female game makers more visible. And I applaud their efforts, frankly. Yeah. I don't think women in the games industry get enough credit at all.
Yeah, I mean, there were stories, by the way, I forgot her name, but she was getting terrible response to tweets. Oh no, I'm sorry, that's Michelle Beadle. I'm thinking of something completely different. Never mind. She's not in the computer games industry. I was just.
Next time you're looking for a tangential off ramp, take one of the ones I've pointed out to you instead of trying to create one yourself.
Okay. Anyway, we're going to go to listener feedback. Go ahead, Paul.
From Alpha Shard. Note on no venerable game players, Robin Williams, though it may be too late to get his opinion on the matter, I do want to highlight his own daughter, another fellow gamer, bullied off of Twitter. I know personally a grandmother who's at least 60 and has... And it has as much of a gamer as me. So my point here is that there are older gamers, though they may be a minority and the majority are maybe immature. The loud and obnoxious ones are making the rest of us look bad. Alpha Shard, you know, I think you might have misunderstood what I was trying to say. And believe me, I very much understand that there are huge amounts of... You know, of older gamers. But my point here is that today's older gamers are very different than the older gamers that we are going to have 30 years from now. Not just because of the inevitable passage of time and the unfortunate things that that does to the human body, but because 30 years from now, the senior game playing community will have been game players that grew up with video games, who already had access to video games when they were 6 and 8 years old, which is going to be very different than today's video game players who were in their, you know, late 30s when video games first came on the market.
I played the original Zelda. It came with a gold cartridges and games came with cartridges and you had to...
I mean, exactly. Like, you know, what we consider our senior gamers now were in their... You know, in their 20s, you know, 20s and 30s when Pong came out.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, it's just a different, you know, I'm not really sure that that's what you really understood, what I was anyway trying to get at.
People are going to be amazed that I played games in arcades. You know, you played
right, like,
back
when I
had a quarter in it?
You know, when I'm saying we have no we don't have a society of venerable game players, it's, you know, people who were born into an age when. There, you know, before there was a thing as not being a video game. In the same way that we were all born in an age when there was no such thing as there not being widely available books.
You know,
it changes your perception of the entire medium.
There's still people alive today who are who grew up without there being any talking pictures. Still, you know.
Right, and so those would be the venerable moviegoers.
You know, I mean. 10 years ago, you'd have people who were you know, growing up before motion pictures existed. You know,
Sorry, strike my last comment from the record. I'm sorry. That came out completely wrong. But it's not a salient enough point to go back to. Moving on. I heard what happened to Anita, and it's horrible what others deem as acceptable behavior. I don't agree with everything she says, but that's no way to treat a person with a differing opinion. Let's face it, the woman has a point. When my daughter asks if she can play a video game with a girl lead and I have to struggle to find ones that aren't scantily clad or just sex objects, I have to give Anita a point. All my daughter wants and all Anita wants and all the rest of the female gamers want is to be represented as more than just digital sex objects, by being represented with real female characters.
You know, just get a DS or something like that and play the old classic versions of JRPGs, which have tons of female characters, and they're always top down and sort of squat, so you really, you know, they're like tile to tile, so you really
they, you know, so they're female leads. They're, and
you know what always strikes me is that in all of these conversations of female leads, is that nobody ever points to Tara from Final Fantasy III on Super Nintendo. I forget what Japanese number that is. But yeah, the game, the green-haired girl, the game starts with her. She has no memory. And even though a whole soap opera cast of other people come in, it's her story. She's the protagonist. And nobody ever points that out.
You know what? There's another game I almost forgot. The Longest Journey. An adventure game. And a lot of, you know, King's Quest V, was it? Which had the princess, you know, it was, you know, had a female lead, Rebecca Williams, shockingly got a lot of flack for having a female lead in a King's Quest game, which I found shocking. And they actually, this is pre-internet, you know, so it's sort of like she still got flack from it for doing that. Oh, King's
Quest, because you could write a letter to her publisher.
King's Quest 4, I think it was. That was the one.
And it's like, and you know what? I think Will Wheaton might have said it best when he was just like, just don't be a dick. Just don't be a dick. I was like, but, come on.
Yeah, but you know, I'm still thinking about getting what's called games that have female leads that aren't, you know, scantily clad, you know, sexualized.
But you know, to be fair,
Mass Effect,
even though
Mass
they were
Effect,
like
you know,
sprites, you know. Those, not that I would say that they were sexualized, but they were definitely given female characteristics, those 2D sprites in that game.
Yeah. I mean, in Mass Effect, a female Shepard, you know, is not sexualized, but there are a lot of sexy women who she deals with.
Look, there's nothing wrong with sexy women as long as there's an equal number of sexy men.
Well, fortunately, these women are also
intelligent. Let's just be upfront
too.
About that. Well, men can also be sexual objects.
Well, here's the thing. The thing is that they're also very intelligent. Miranda and Jack and, you know, and Ashley, they're all very, very intelligent. So I guess, so. I mean, Mass Effect is probably the safest one right now that I can think of. Also, there's no, but that game's
all right. But we're going back to last week's news. Moving on. When I see games advertised on various websites in the sidebar with scantily clad women and with oversized breasts that are barely covered, I know that I am being pandered to. Very good, Alpha Shard. We applaud your self-awareness. As I like to point out, the Sierra games had several strong female characters and in lead roles, like Rosella in King's Quest 4 and 7, Laura Bow in Dagger of Amun-Ra and Cornell's Bequest, Grace Nakamura from Gabriel Knight. Oh, I remember Grace. Elsa Arena Arazilla from Quest of Glory. Okay, so endless examples we can go on.
But those are all adventure games.
Right. The world didn't end when it was revealed that Samus Aran was a woman in Metroid. Why should we stop there? I'm still waiting for a co-op Zelda in a Link game, Nintendo. I'm still waiting for a co-op Zelda and Link game, Nintendo. Oh, okay, I get it. Yeah, usually she just kind of, Zelda even gets a mitigated role in her own legend. She only kind of comes in for the final battle.
Princess.
I hate when you do that. I hate when you do that because nobody remembers that show but me. And that wasn't even annoying to a 7-year-old. Okay, so I don't know why you choose to make fun of that. It does nothing but annoy me when you say that in my ear.
But what about Captain Gay? What about Captain? I forgot his name.
Captain Planet.
Captain the Game Master. Captain N, the Game Master. Right.
Yeah. What about him?
Nothing. I was just bringing him up because they had a crossover.
Completely different show. They had
a crossover with Zelda.
I wouldn't go so far as to call it a crossover. I would call it a tangentially related universe.
They use the same character voices, though.
They did use the same character voices because, let's face it, that was awesome of them. But they had everything else was completely different. They had a different art universe. Everything else was just different.
You know, the nostalgic critic pointed out that Link was always trying to get a kiss from Zelda in that show, and she immediately gives a kiss to Kevin right in front of Link, which probably made him go mentally deranged for a moment. You know, you kissed him?
What about me? You know, that sort of thing. I just, you know.
I'm very proud of you, Jonah. You can spot comedy.
Anyways. So, moving on.
Like, dude, I was 6 when that was on the air. And of course I saw that. Like, come on. You're trying to tell me the Earth is round, dude.
Yeah, but not everybody knows it. This is a podcast. We are imparting information to everybody.
All right, you know what? I'm just going to pretend that all of our listeners are adults.
Okay.
Because I give them that much credit. Moving back to AlphaShard, you're right about the violent reaction because I think the gamers are showing outrage are the ones that are afraid their digital sex toys are going to be taken away from them. That isn't what is being asked. All that is being asked is for more stronger female characters to be shown, for women to be accepted as people and not just playthings. And why stop there? Why not have different races, nationalities, ideologies, sexual preferences, etc.? I think I like you, AlphaShard.
You know what?
Let me just finish his thoughts on this one topic. It's disgusting to me that some of my fellow gamers are treating women and anyone different from them, from their norm, so poorly. I grew up feeling like an outcast because I played games and read fantasy novels. I was seen as the weirdo, and I didn't meet any female gamers at all during school. Once after school, though, I saw that there were many female gamers, and it made me feel accepted and more like a part of humanity, knowing that I wasn't some freak oddball. AlphaShard, are you female? Go you! Hey.
You know, here's the thing: is that it reminds me the entire thing of getting upset at having their toes. You know, it makes me sort of snort when these guys are saying, why do you have a gay shepherd? You know, the thing is that you're not forced to have that relationship. You don't have to go through that branch just because it's there and it's possible. Doesn't mean they're ruining your shepherd. It's the story that you want to tell. And the fact that you might do it doesn't invalidate the one you want to play. So let people play their shepherd their way. So the story branches out in their way. You're not forced to have that option. You know, it just is ridiculous to me. Especially in Dragon Age. I mean, Dragon Age, they've been going berserk over the romantic interests. They've been really what the possible ones were. And it's like, you don't have to play it that way. You play it the way you want to play it. You know, just because other people can play it that way doesn't mean that you're forced to as well. Sort of thing.
Yes. Moving on.
You could have agreed with me.
I did agree with you.
Yeah, but
my point is that we've kind of hammered this issue to death over the last 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I would like to finish reading AlphaShard's copy here. Because I'm still not done on this topic. So to see other gamers reject female gamers just boggles my mind. Do men who favor sports reject having women join in? Do men at car shows say, look at that fake car girl. She shouldn't be here. It's beyond my comprehension at all that the, quote, fake gamer girls aren't calling every girl with an opinion a feminazi. It's time for the boys who seem to be stuck in high school to grow up already.
I don't think they're stuck in high school. I think they're stuck in elementary school.
And you know what? I have some fascinating theories that I would love to go into in more depth, but that would be the task for another day, because some of what I have to say might not really be that popular. But moving on, at the question of the week, AlphaShard loved playing World of Warcraft, but it was a time sink of a game. AlphaShard's most memorable moments weren't the raids or the instances, but the times where AlphaShard was just hanging out with friends around a fishing pond or traveling through the air on AlphaShard's Griffin. I also seem to be one of the few human players who went and got a giant tiger mount from the elves.
That was hard.
You know what? This goes back to one of my fundamental game design observations, and you guys really should like take note of this one if you want to be video game designers, is that fishing makes every single video game better. Like, you have no idea how much fishing will improve any good video game design.
Well, you know what? I think it's because it's like a break in time, and it's like okay, I'm gonna take a break here. You don't have to be at 500 miles an hour the entire time, and sometimes you need a breather.
That's absolutely the reasoning behind it, but I do like to offer my pieces of advice into, you know, memorable nuggets. Yeah, if you're ever screwed, just add fishing to your game. Maybe your fishing might need a different narrative wrapper, but yeah, fishing as a concept also fantastic. I mean, look at Link. Anyway, moving on. While I like superhero stories, the fantasy setting is what does it for me. And I believe that is the end of Alpha Shard's response.
Nope, it's a little bit more.
Oh, you want me to Alpha Shard, the question of the week comes at the end. A little update. Laurie and Corey Cole, the makers of Quest for Glory, had an update on their Kickstarter, Hero U. In it, they discussed the issue about the hate towards females in games and players themselves. Quote, we have been very disturbed by the degree of hate towards the indie game developers and women developers and players in particular. On many websites, personally, I think it comes from jealousy. The commenters want the publicity and success of the game developers without devoting the years of 60-hour weeks it takes to build a game. Unfortunately, a lot of this has come across in the form of hate towards women. This isn't new. Roberta Williams got hate mail for featuring Rosella as the main character in King's Quest IV, but it's just plain wrong. Games can be fun with either male or female protagonists as long as their story reflects that choice. Buffy the Vampire Slayer with a male slayer? Boring. Okay. I'm sorry. I can't agree with that boy slayers would be awesome too. It breaks the fiction that they were creating in that world.
Okay, we're going to stop with that email because it runs on. So you don't have to. It just basically covers the same ground that you had before. So we can just stop there. But, Angel is sort of like a male slayer even though he's a vampire. I mean.
Yeah, same kind of thing. And that's one of my biggest gripes with certain individuals on this podcast is that they cannot differentiate between mechanics and narrative wrappers.
Yeah. I personally like Giles best, but that's just me.
Yeah.
Okay. The next email is from Arthur V. At all the things that are wrong with the gaming world. This debate has been going on for a long time, and I'm not sure I can add anything that hasn't already been said. To be honest, I am indifferent to the opinions of general gaming mass. They can be homophobic, sexist, or even Marxist, for all I care, as long as they don't cause other people trouble.
It's a shame they're not Darwinists. Just kill themselves.
What I find worrying the most is discrimination in the gaming industry itself. Mature, highly educational professionals who are often in the position of power over others are the worst kind. They can genuinely harm the well-being of others with their discrimination and often do so. I would say sorting the industry out is a priority. Trying to change the gaming as a whole is impossible at this moment. This all reminds me of the gaming, quote-unquote, civil rights movement of the sixth generation, which was fueled by the release of Grand Theft Auto San Andreas. Many gamers pointed out that the African Caribbeans were highly underrepresented as main protagonists. Not much has changed since then. My friend still complains when we play an Asian MMO and the only character he can make is a very attractive white male.
What's wrong with an attractive white male? I've been looking for one for years.
At all the lovely times I did not play World of Warcraft. My first time playing World of Warcraft was 2012. I spent weeks downloading the 32-gigabyte patch, and when I finally played, I was lamed out. Since I played many World of Warcraft clones beforehand, I found that World of Warcraft itself to be very dated in comparison. Because you've been playing World of Warcraft clones, you've already been playing it, you know? I didn't bother playing it past the first quest, especially since my friend dropped out of the game saying that Mists of Pandaria update made it crap. So there you go.
I was going to say something, and I forgot what it was. It must not have been that important, although that's highly unlikely.
Can you talk about how World of Warcraft ruined Cities of Heroes again?
No.
Okay.
See, I am completely once we say something, we should move on to say something new, because otherwise we're just boring our listeners.
You did say that you were bored with a fantasy MMO, and you wanted something other than fantasy, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know what? I mean, the European and Eastern European folklores have provided us fantastic content for not only games, but for films and television and novels for untold decades. But I definitely think that there are other mythologies out there which can be just as inspiring for making video games. Native American folklore, African folklore.
An MMO.
All the various Asian, Asian folklore, which makes absolutely no sense to me. I mean,
they have Wack Fu. I mean, that's starting to age of Wack Fu.
Like, I'm just kind of getting over like the whole, you know, knights of chivalry and princesses and kind of thing.
There is a game that I'm interested in that I should try sometimes now, free to play, and that's The Secret World, which is basically takes place in present time, except it's sort of like Lovecraftian Cthulhu, all the conspiracy.
Oh my god, I so don't want to hear any more about Lovecraft or Cthulhu.
Well, I mean, it's more Illuminati sort of stuff, but it has some...
Oh my god, done to death. It's like the next steampunk.
Yeah, but not an MMO. And not certainly not one that takes place in present day. I mean, Destiny at least is a science fiction shooter MMO, although that's been done to death with Planetside. But they do it a lot better than Planetside, I just have to say.
Anyway. I'm just calling for unique narratives. Oh, wait, that's what I was talking about. The civil rights issue in games. And you know, it's something that I don't really understand all of the time. Because there's even this same kind of complaint in the My Little Pony universe.
Oh boy! Now what?
Yeah. So apparently, there's you know the princess Deus Ex Machina, who often comes in and solves everybody's problems, and she's got guards obviously because she's the princess and that's what a princess does is sit around with her guards all day, and all of her Pegasus guards are white furred, and all of her unicorn guards have kind of a chocolatey, ashy kind of complexion, and that's just because. That's just because they were looking to offset things that, you know, they were looking for color choices as artists to offset the colors of the standard blue and gold armor that all of the princess's guards wear. So people complain, like, why all the unicorns got to be black? It's like, are you kidding me? You are reading too much into this. It's like her guards are... not like they don't fall into the same construct of human skin color.
They're unis.
They're unicorns. Yeah. Don't call them unis.
But there's only one uni, and it was a small.
Don't white I can't. Dungeons I can't. You're gonna make me throw up. Don't make.
Oh,
me
Oh, you didn't like
don't
Dungeons and Dragons?
Don't make me go there.
I think that was Frank Welker too.
Don't make me go there.
I always
for any of our listeners who might not have been around at the time, we're talking about the 1980s Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, which had a little boy and his pet unicorn, and
I wanted to
it
smack
was the
around,
worst.
It was Bobby, right? I want to smack around Bobby. Such an annoying little prick.
Oh, but come on.
I know you
really...
probably thought Eric was hot, didn't you? Eric the Cavalier?
No, he was annoying.
Oh,
come on. Blonde, but it's comedy. Bobby was like a 6-year-old and he had the magical club of the barbarian and was the team's actor.
Yeah, that's fine.
That's comedy. That's... But it was that annoying unicorn. Fucking shut up.
So you wish, you know, I don't know. I
under worst unicorns of all time, you might see that picture.
So anyways, the question of the week is, have you ever created your own content with a game's editor? Getting back to development.
This is what I do for a living, so it's not really a fair question.
Well, I did a lot of Heroes of Might and Magic maps, you know, and I did them really well. And, well, here's the thing. They're published in Eastern Europe. Because people would always ask me, is it okay if I include
your
maps?
Good for you.
Is it always
good for you.
Is it okay if I include your maps in our little bundle that we're going to be selling? And say, sure, why not? Never saw a penny from it. I didn't expect to get a penny from it. I didn't care. Just enjoy it. You know, I also experimented a lot with Unreal Ed for Unreal Tournament. That was difficult to do for me. So that's your job, you said. But let me ask you a question. Did you do it before you went into game development?
Yeah, because I remember back in my undergrad days, we messed around with the same kinds of things. The Heroes of Might and Magic level editors. I mean, that's what we had.
Yeah.
To play with at the time.
Heroes of Might and Magic 3 and 4 were so good.
Oh my god, 3 was amazing. Yeah. I have 5 currently installed on my computer.
I have 6.
No, not as good.
I have 6 because it was part of a Steam sale. I haven't really gotten around to playing it. I will at some point. But the thing that bothered me about 5 was that it didn't come with an editor. And that ruined it for me. Because every time I got a new Heroes of Might and Magic, the first thing I would do is I would create in a map, you know? And I couldn't create maps, you know? So
but
it's like
I'm also
killed
the kind
my interest.
Of person, but I mean, I'm also the kind of person who was really into developing their own terrain for their SimCity plot back in the day.
SimCity 4? Or it's just SimCity 3? For me,
SimCity 1?
The original I played that too. I'm just saying SimCity 4 was a highlight for me when it came to terrain. That's all.
Yeah, because I mean, because you know what? Because I hated water features. Mm. I hated, I hated hills. Except for, of course, the pyramid of waterfall that I wanted to erect in every level.
I always
level.
Did that in every SimCity game. I would just have a lot of waterfall so that I could have the hydro generators all along that waterfall. It's like this mountain with streams going down the side of it, and dotting it were all these water generators. And say,
right, the waterfall pyramid.
Yeah. I made it, well, it was more of a pyramid with the earlier ones. Four made them too smooth looking to be an actual pyramid. You know, it's more like a...
But you know, I'm going back to my childhood when we played SimCity 1 and we liked it. God damn it.
Anyway, so that's the question of the week. Have you ever created your own content with a game editor? Look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. You can share your feedback. So leave us comments at our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast or the forums at GamingPodcast.net/home. Or send your comments to fans@GamingPodcast.net. Also, subscribe to us on iTunes and leave some iTunes comments. I haven't checked to see if there are any new iTunes comments for Gaming Podcast.
Maybe I haven't looked.
Maybe there are some new ones. You know, and it's always nice to see someone commenting and giving a 5-star review for whatever you have on. Okay, so anyways, we'll see you next week.
Bye, Bonds.